This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. Heart medications are showing up in local waterways and fish, part of a larger issue of prescription contamination.
Our bodies are not perfect. They're never going to ingest and process 100% of the drug. We will end up excreting some quantity of this food.
That story and more coming up this West Virginia Morning. Support for West Virginia Morning is proudly provided by Luke Frazier. The Mountain Valley Pipeline could start moving natural gas anytime now. As Curtis Tate reports, the people who live near it still have questions about their safety and health.
On Tuesday, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission approved the pipeline to begin operating. That's despite a flood of comments on the commission's public docket in recent weeks opposing or seeking to delay the decision. Last month, the pipe burst during water pressure testing in Roanoke County, Virginia, and state and federal regulators haven't shared much information about what happened. Natalie Cox, a spokeswoman for Equitrans Midstream, which built the 303-mile pipeline, didn't give a timeline for when the gas would begin moving through it. People in affected communities are now wondering what to expect, including Russell Chisholm of Newport, Virginia, co-director of Protect Our Water Heritage Rights.
You know, I think it's weighing heavily on everybody all up and down the 303 miles of the route.
Chisholm said there were likely to be problems with leaks that could affect residents' health. Autumn Crow, interim executive director of the West Virginia Rivers Coalition, said safety remained a concern for communities near the pipeline.
It's important for everyone along the route to know when and how much gas is going through the pipeline.
Jessica Sims, Virginia field coordinator for Appalachian Voices, said regulators had not done enough to reassure the public of the pipeline's integrity or share sufficient detail about the failed pressure test on May 1st.
The public is still in the dark about important safety and environmental considerations from the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration and FERC.
The groups conceded they had few legal options remaining to challenge the pipeline, but would continue to monitor it. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Curtis Tate in Charleston.
West Virginia is one of the top recipients of a federal program called SNAP. The Supplemental Nutrition Program provides food for more than 40 million Americans. The Us and Them team recently won a Best Podcast Award from the Virginia's AP Broadcasters for a show focused on that food support system. Here's an excerpt from that show with host Trey Kay.
Initially, we thought about focusing this episode on where SNAP fits into America's larger political debate. After all, this is us and them. We could hear from SNAP recipients and from those who play a role in the political process of shaping its benefits. Then we came across someone who knows both.
I think that a lot of lawmakers are reluctant to talk about some of these needs because in doing so, you run the risk of coming across less than compassionate.
That brings us to part three of our story, the politician. Jonathan Pinson represents the 17th District of West Virginia's House of Delegates. It sits on the western border of the state and includes parts of Mason and Jackson counties. Pinson was first elected in 2020. He's a Republican and a Baptist pastor.
I believe that the SNAP benefit program overall is well-suited and well-intended to address the need of hunger. When you look at it from a societal point of view, there are certainly some great advantages to that, not just to the supplemental side of the income, but then also to the nutritional aspects of it as well, so that we're encouraging the fruits and the vegetables and the dairies and all of these things.
That got me thinking about my trip to the grocery store with Renee Kittle. I explained her situation to him and how she couldn't afford any of that healthy produce.
Well, I think that that any rational person would empathize with that situation. What we find really when we're considering the SNAP program or other governmental assistant programs is a place where a multitude of issues converge. And oftentimes it's been my experience that what we as a government should do and what we as a government can do are two different things. Having a working understanding of the fact that state government and federal government alike has to work within budget. We could bring into this convergence of all the issues converging into her home and say, well, maybe if we would waste less money in other places, we would have more opportunity to help in situations like the SNAP program.
That's an excerpt from the award-winning episode of Us and Them, SNAP, Do the Hungry Get More Policy Than Nutrition? You can download all of the Us and Them podcasts from Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, NPR One, or Spotify. You can also listen online at wvpublic.org. Us and Them is supported by the West Virginia Humanities Council and the CRC Foundation. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:50. Patchy fog this morning, becoming partly sunny today. Highs in the 80s and low 90s. Mostly clear tonight, lows in the 60s. Tomorrow, mostly sunny. A slight chance of afternoon rain and thunderstorms in the north. High temperatures in the 80s. Support for WVPB is provided by the West Virginia Renaissance Festival. Starting June 8th, presenting four weekends of live jousting, feasting, shopping, entertainment on seven stages. For more information, WVRENFEST.com. Heart diseases are the most prevalent medical conditions in the country, and drugs like statin blockers and beta blockers are widely prescribed to help treat them. But new research reveals that those drugs are now showing up in local waterways and fish. Reporter Chris Schultz spoke with Professor Kyle Hartman and doctoral student Joseph Kingsbury, who you will hear speaking first about their research into this issue.
What are we talking about when we're talking about heart medications?
In the terms and the scope of the study that kind of falls under statins and beta blockers, there are additional heart medicines out there. Obviously, there are probably several dozen at minimum in circulation right now, but we primarily focused on the statins and the beta blockers.
What led you all to, first of all, even be looking for these medications in our waterways?
For a long time, I've been kind of interested in this. And so, you know, some of these drugs, I'll let Joe talk about the beta blockers, but the statin drugs, you know, for us, it's like, you know, we're trying to control cholesterol and fat and things like that in our bodies. And so, you know, they're pretty much, you hit 40 years old and they prescribe you for these things, whether you need it or not. They're very prevalent out there. But, you know, for fish in particular, it's important for them to be able to store lipids in order to get through lean times, to make it through the winter. And in terms of reproduction, lipids are what fuels that egg in a fish in order to be able to hatch and survive and, you know, make the next generation. Anything that would reduce lipids, that reduces an already low chance of survival for that egg. That's its fuel. So anything that would reduce that for them might be affecting recruitment or reproduction of fish. It may not be a lethal thing. There's still not something that we can observe. Because it's probably just eroding, it could be eroding the population. So I was interested in it from the perspective of this could be sort of a silent negative thing happen to our fish populations, where we might see those that are exposed to these lipid drugs, their populations declining, and we don't know why, because we can't see the smoking gun that in this case would potentially be the statin drugs.
Can you explain to me, you know, where you all are theorizing that this is coming from?
It's purely going through wastewater. Joe could give you more details.
For the most part, when we ingest these types of pharmaceuticals, our bodies are not perfect. They're never going to ingest and process 100% of the drug. It varies from pharmaceutical to pharmaceutical, but basically we will end up excreting, usually through our urine or our feces, some quantity of this pharmaceutical. And because they are very resistant to actual degradation, because they're meant to be shelf stable, they're meant to be processed in a very specific way within our bodies, they hit our wastewater treatment facilities, which actually don't recreate those same processes. And so they don't always break down and basically remove these pharmaceuticals as waste. And so what ends up happening is, you know, we treat all this water and stuff, and we go, okay, it's clean, it's safe enough to return back to our surface waters, and we just discharge it. But we never actually specifically treat it for the pharmaceuticals per se. It's detected globally at this point. And usually the sewage treatment facilities are our primary source, which just aren't equipped to really treat for these pharmaceuticals and these more complex compounds.
What's the next step for your study?
Traditionally, this study is done in more urbanized environments, like, say, Pittsburgh, for example, versus we typically ignore rural areas because of low population densities. The next step really would be to basically create more accurate estimates of the pharmaceuticals entering the waterways over time. And that is hard to do, but it's not impossible. Part of that involves more rigorous water quality testing to get a better feel for how that fluctuates over time, because there's going to be seasonality to it.
And just seasonally, in terms of discharge in the river, you know, the old dilution is the solution to pollution. You know, when we've got higher flows, we still probably got the same amount of drugs going in. It's just it's more dilute.
Yeah, mapping that seasonality in relation to both also demographics. And so that was part of my study as well, as looking at how the demographics of West Virginia could potentially contribute. And so that's kind of the next big step, is, you know, getting a better feel for what areas need to be prioritized for further research. And to even see it in rural areas tells us that this is not just a city-based problem. This is a everywhere problem, most likely.
What is the desired outcome for this?
I think ultimately, it's like we're still trying to understand, you know, where these drugs are affecting things. We probably should give a shout out to Dr. Sanchez, who Joe worked with up at Pittsburgh on the methods to actually be able to detect this in water and in fish. But ultimately, if we have information that shows, you know, these drugs are way worse for the fish and the environment, then maybe we need to use, there are plenty of alternate medications that maybe aren't.
Oftentimes we talk about risk and risk mitigation, and just highlighting which drugs even require risk mitigation is part of our current problem of understanding of what is actually happening. And unfortunately, all pharmaceuticals are pretty unique. They're probably, I would argue, one of the most challenging contaminants of our time, because they're also unique in the way they target our biological, they're like designed to target biological pathways, both in us and in fish, because we share a lot of the same pathways. I think for us right now, we're still at the information gathering stage to even begin recommending changes to certain industries, whether it's the pharmaceutical companies, wastewater treatment management, or even doctors in terms of what they prescribe. I still think we're a ways out from that, because we just don't fully understand the full picture yet. And so that's kind of, right now we're still trying to untangle this huge ball of yarn that is pharmaceutical contamination.
That was Joseph Kingsbury and Kyle Hartman speaking with reporter Chris Schultz about their research into pharmaceutical contamination in our waterways. You can read a longer version of this interview at our website at wvpublic.org. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University. West Virginia Morning is produced with help from Bill Lynch, Brianna Heaney, Chris Schultz, Curtis Tate, Emily Rice, Eric Douglas, Jack Walker, Liz McCormick, and Maria Young. Chris Schultz produced today's show. I'm your host, Teresa Wills. This is West Virginia Morning.